This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision-making from two Canadians. We're hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore, portfolio managers at PWL Capital.
Welcome to episode 178. Have a couple of quick show references for you. One I'm sure most people are already watching, which is Yellowstone. You watching Yellowstone by chance?
No.
The Dutton Family Ranch. Oh my God, it's fantastic. Kevin Costner, crazy, awful things that they do to protect their land in Montana. Anyways, great show. Another one, remember a couple of weeks ago we talked about a 90s show that Lisa and I watched. So a friend of ours, Chris, reached out and said, oh, you got to watch The Dark Side of the 90s, which is on Crave in Canada. So we started watching it yesterday. Wow. To go back to these times, like pre-internet and pre-so many things, like the episode yesterday we watched was about the Beanie Babies, which I was not a Beanie Baby fan, but to learn that online selling eBay basically started with Beanie Babies, if you can believe it.
Wow.
Completely crazy. But even the sounds, you know, dial-up internet and all these things at the time that they referenced, it was certainly for people who lived through the 90s, it was really interesting. So we're kind of hooked on that show too.
Wait, so what's the dark side? You just talked about Beanie Babies and dial-up internet. What's the...
Well, no, the dark side that they talk about, one is that talk shows were created in the 90s, so Oprah, and then led into Jerry Springer. The dark side of that was talking about how Jerry Springer basically capitalized on the worst part of humanity and made it kind of like a television show, like a car crash. You just can't stop watching this horrible stuff. Then that morphed into what the internet in the late 90s took over with sharing of all kinds of crazy stuff. And another dark side was, we're only two episodes in, was a whole drug scene in LA. So the Viper, was it called the Viper Lounge or something, a famous club in LA, and River Phoenix dying. So they talk about that. So those are some of the dark sides. Anyways, the dark side of Beanie Babies was how the creator Ty, I forget his family name, but the creator Beanie Babies ended up cutting off supply of certain Beanie Babies, which made the price go through the roof. And then he said at the end of 1999, we're going to stop making Beanie Babies. So, of course, the prices just kept going up. People buying out supplies everywhere around the world and fighting over Beanie Babies and even the baby Beanie Babies at McDonald's. And then only a few months later to come out and say, oh, we're coming back with new Beanie Babies. So the price plummeted and the whole thing imploded.
Crazy.
Completely crazy. Some great reviews lately. I Love Tofu said that I love this podcast, but I heard the opening as from two Canadians. I wasn't sure if it was relevant to me as a non-Canadian. So we did make the change that was suggested here from a couple of Canadians. Hopefully it's more clear now. We think it is.
Oh, they've understood it as from Canadians to Canadians. From slash two is what they wrote. From two. It's from two people who are Canadian.
That's true. I didn't pick up on that. That's from a couple of Canadians. R2134 said, great knowledge and summary. This podcast will make you a better investor if you take the time to listen closely and reflect, unlike many podcasts, which are a little more than opinion editorials. It's very nice. Thanks so much for that feedback. Life Like No Other said, this is a great resource for financial literacy. Marie Roy said, can't recommend this enough. I started listening to the podcast in the beginning of 2021. Has not missed a single episode yet. As a newbie in the finance space, I can't say I completely understand all the minutiae and details that we go into with our guests, but I've enjoyed each episode and consider them as an opportunity to learn something new, which is what we're trying to accomplish here. Also, Marie said that she's gotten a lot more out of her Audible subscription thanks to my amazing book recommendations. I never know how the book recommendations go, but a few people have said they enjoy them. So
you know people like them. That's like one of the most frequent feedback that we get on the podcast is how much people like your book recommendations.
From the store, get your order in for Christmas. We're getting orders out right away as they come in. And let's face it, who doesn't like one of our hoodies? Hoodie sales have been slow lately, but do you know what's selling like crazy? Are these Talking Sense cards. We have to put in another order. We're almost through 250 packs.
Wow.
If you can believe it. We have maybe, I don't know, 30 or 40 left, I think, in the storage.
That's wild. I would have guessed that would have been like a year's supply. How long did that take us to go through them?
What's it been, 3 months maybe?
Wow.
So Angelica's ordered more. And just a reminder, we run the store pretty much break even after shipping. So love to get more merchandise out there to you. Just a reminder, connect with us on Instagram at Rational Reminder. I'm on Peloton at CP313 and hashtag Rational Reminder. Speaking of Peloton, have you seen their share price lately? It's down like 75% from its pandemic high. So I heard Scott Galloway on a podcast this morning suggesting that, you know, with a valuation now around 16 billion US, he's saying it should be a great takeover target for a company like perhaps Apple, or even better, he says Nike, because Nike desperately needs to get into the digital space. So he thinks it would be a great takeover target there. He says, I don't care about valuations. He says, just to get that kind of audience, it'd be worth even 50% premium over current share price. That is not a stock recommendation, just an anecdotal story looking at something that's dropped so far so fast.
Did they talk about why? Or did you, have you heard about why the price is down so much? Just bad earnings or what?
Well, I think bad earnings. I think a lot of people are hopping off of Peloton in post-pandemic and going back to the gym. The average user's usage per month is falling. Anything else to add?
Nope. I've still never tried a Peloton. I've got my fan bike. I met a guy who does welding and he made some stuff for my house. And I asked him if he could extend the seat on my fan bike, because I'm pretty tall and the seat's not made for my height. So he took it and he's extending it for me. It's pretty exciting.
Do you have to extend the handlebars also?
I usually actually don't use them. I usually kind of sit back and don't use the handlebars. So I think if I were to use the bike properly, I would have to extend them, but I have not been using them.
Well, one last thing I wanted to put out there was, for those that haven't checked out the podcast on YouTube, it's really worth checking out. Our animator, Matt Gambino, is doing some fabulous work every week, improving it. And it's really good.
Yeah. It's very cool to see his creativity coming through, just the way that he presents the videos, but also he's working in more graphics. Like, we've tried to do that historically when possible, but having Matt on the team with us just makes it a lot more seamless, I guess, to do stuff like that. So yeah, that's been cool.
And he's also working hard on the year-end show, which I think we're going to have, you know, more than 40 little clips of audio. So he's going to do a nice job on that, I'm sure.
And you put that together. You put all the clips together, or assembled all the clips for the year-end show. You said it was a pretty impressive year of conversations to review.
Incredible year of conversations. But you realize that my job is a whole lot easier than what, you know, Matt has to do to pull us all together from a video standpoint. It's going to be an incredible episode. Hard to get it down to, you know, a few dozen audio segments, but we'll see. And I'm sure what I've chosen, what you would choose, would be different. But no matter what, when you've got a lineup like we've had this year, it's going to be a great year-end wrap-up.
I mean, you've nailed it the last couple of years, so I wouldn't worry about differences in how each of us would do it.
All right, shall we get to the episode?
Let's go. Welcome to episode 178 of the Rational Minder Podcast.
I have a great book review for you this week. In fact, it's a bit of a combo review. So it started with our good friend Aidan Mersey, who is the CEO of Ottawa-based Fellow, and he hosts the podcast called Super Managers. And he recently interviewed Colin Breyer in episode 70. So Colin Breyer, for those who don't know, was Jeff Bezos' right-hand person at Amazon for many years. So Aidan's interview inspired me to go and read the book that Colin co-authored with Bill Carr, called Working Backwards, Insights, Stories, and Secrets from Inside Amazon. Aidan's interview was phenomenal. The book is phenomenal. I learned so much, and I'm going to be like Aidan, which you go back and reread this book a number of times. I've already listened to the interview twice. So Breyer and Carr are both former execs at Amazon and were there very early on. And they were a significant part of the executive team during the early years of what is obviously an unbelievable growth story. So they wrote this book to articulate how leadership and management works at Amazon. And did you know that Amazon now has over 1.3 million employees? It's just mind-boggling.
That's a lot of people.
A lot of people, a lot of product lines, a lot of verticals. So how do they ever pull this off? So that's what this book is about. So I'm not about to go through a complete summary, but there are some pretty cool takeaways. So the title, Working Backwards, simply means to be customer obsessed. And Jeff Bezos is absolutely customer obsessed. So you're always working backwards with the customer problem being the objective of what you're trying to solve. I mean, a perfect example, last night we're at home and my probe in my oven to do a roast broke. You know, within 30 seconds, I had a new one ordered on Amazon. You think of the old days of going, like, where would you go to find it? You got to drive across town. You got, oh, they don't have it in stock. Like 30 seconds, and it's at home now. It's already been delivered. This is Sunday night, I ordered it. Point number two, even in the face of urgency, it's critical to hire the right people. Hire your way out of a problem, but hire properly. So they call it the bar raiser process. And they have a whole process they go through in the book about how they do interviews and how they avoid bias in interviews, how they avoid bias in ranking, how everyone felt about the interview. Very, very impressive. Number three, which we've talked about before, which is break out teams into smaller decision-making units. They call it the two pizza groups. So to keep the entrepreneurial feel, they want groups to be able to be fed by two pizzas. So it's probably like 10 people or so is an ideal group size. This next one is pretty interesting. You must fail often to hit it big. So for example, they failed miserably with the Fire Phone. However, they had monster success with a Kindle, Amazon Music, Amazon Prime, Prime Video, Alexa, AWS, and all of these items were questioned big time before they were launched. As issues, this is another really cool one. As issues would come up and they become bigger, more complicated, they came up with a process to enable a leadership team to make better decisions. So the end result was that PowerPoint was forbidden. Any proposal you had, it had to be done in a written format because a written format forces more consideration by the presenter, more clarity of thought, more effort, and it gives equal weighting to the quality of the work that goes into it, not on the ability of the presenter to work PowerPoint. So they said it's a better way to get better ideas and better information shared to all people and the crux of the decision to better focus for the people to make decisions. I thought that was a great idea. The other thing they always do before going ahead with a new project is they write a press release. And that press release, of course, is not issued, but it's an example of what they do to think about the client problem they're solving is to highlight the benefit to the customer in that press release. Another thing they do too is they focus on the input metrics of the business more so than the output metrics. Like what are the activities that you can control? They focus on that much more than the profitability on the other side. Then they go into some examples of product lines that came to life like Kindle, absolutely brilliant. Like I love my Kindle, but the Kindle came out of the problem that the customer was having at the time because there were books coming out, but they're not easy to read on the iPad, for example, or on different computers. Jeff Bezos wanted to get a device where you could have all in one spot, a comfortable device, easy on your eyes, easy to order as things came up. That's where the Kindle came from, and clearly it worked. Amazon Prime came up with solving a problem of customers were having, which is they didn't like the delivery cost. That was the biggest hurdle to placing orders was the shipping cost. This took care of that. Prime Video. Crazy. I mean, this was a series of failures before they decided to create their own content. So create and curate on one side and deliver on the other side. And in fact, remember Jennifer Risher was on back in episode 145. So her husband, which we talked about in that episode, was part of the book because he was senior VP of the Prime delivery execution. And then the last one I'll highlight is AWS, which is a monster part of Amazon's business. AWS simply started as a service for querying the referral program, and then it became an API for the web store. But the problem they wanted to solve was, as they put it, they wanted a student in a college dorm room to have the same amount of computing power as someone working at Google. That was the mission, and they did it. And now look at the size of it. So as they put it, the key principles that Amazonians follow are be customer obsessed, think long term, value innovation, and stay connected to the details. So phenomenal book. Can't recommend it enough. And shout out to Aiden for the interview and for the book recommendation.
Very cool.
A couple of news articles that I came up with last week that I thought might be interesting for us to talk about. So just quickly, these two articles. One talks about how Vanguard, which is a very strong player in the independent advice channel with the personal advisor services, and we've talked about them before, they're coming out with five new, what they call high conviction active funds that will be offered only to the personal advisor services clients. And they talk about in the article how the goal of Vanguard is to make this service more attractive to high net worth clients. It said potentially be more profitable, but Vanguard's a mutually owned company. So I'm kind of curious what their motivation is. Is it to make the product more sexy, more saleable. I don't think it's about margin capture. And the other article talks about how Wealthfront, which is the huge US-based robo-advisor, is looking for a buyer. So Wealthfront has $25 billion of assets under management. They tried to do a reverse merger with a SPAC, but that failed. Wealthfront, and I didn't know this, how many times they pivoted, but they've pivoted every other year since they were founded in 2008. And most recently, they've become like Robinhood, allowing investors to be more self-directed. And we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. They've also opened up the platform to cryptocurrency. So it's interesting to read these two articles and go back to, you know, the Amazon story, which is if you're customer obsessed, how do these moves fit into your corporate strategy? Like if you showed up to Wealthfront 6 to 8 years ago and expecting an evidence-based, globally diversified index portfolio of ETFs, you might be kind of shocked today. It's more about kind of gamification, quasi Robinhood and crypto. Same thing if you went to Vanguard and expected similar kind of experience, all of a sudden now you're being pitched, maybe a strong word, but being proposed high conviction active funds, even though they're low expense ratio funds. It's like, is that what the advisors really wanted? So what's the motivation here? I don't have an answer. I just think it's an interesting question to think about.
Yeah, I doubt it's for the advisors in the Vanguard case. It's potentially really for, like they say, it's to attract high net worth clients, which I can believe that. It's true that people want fancy stuff. When they feel like they're a wealthy individual or if they feel like they're a high net worth individual, I think it's probably more common to see people seeking fancier stuff, probably because it's often sold to them. So I would believe that one. The Wealthfront is fascinating. They were the ones that started the whole robo concept. And for a while there, everyone in traditional wealth management was concerned about the robo advisors, but that clearly hasn't panned out.
Not at all. And in fact, the average fee charged by RIA advisors in the past decade hasn't moved, I think, more than a basis point or two. So people were petrified a decade ago.
Very interesting.
Anyways, we have a lot of listeners that work in this space. I'm sure there'll be lots of thoughts about this. I think it is interesting, though, for consumers to think about, you know, who's behind the firm that you're choosing to work with and what's their motivating factor for what they're bringing to you. Just worthwhile questions to ask. All right, listener question?
Yep. So this question came up in the community. I thought it was worth touching on briefly. Somebody asked, has anyone looked at the trend of dramatically lower annual IPOs in the past 20 years compared to the prior 20? And the shrinking number of listed publicly traded companies traded in the US to see if either of these trends influence implied value premium? There was a related paper from Dimensional, a white paper in 2017, or I think it was a 2018 paper maybe. Not on value, but on the size premium, which is, I think, what the question was really getting at. So Dimensional finds that from 1975 to 1997, the number of names in the US increased from 4,530 to more than 7,000. So that's 75 to 97. Keeping in mind, 97 was the late 90s when there were lots of IPOs. The number of stocks declined over the last two decades to approximately 3,400 in 2017. And globally, this was interesting because they're kind of saying, okay, there's this issue of declining stocks in the US. Globally, it has not been the same. Global stocks have been increasing from 1990 to 2017. The number of names outside the US increased from 9,739 to 39,333. So downward trajectory for the number of names in the US, but big upward trajectory outside of the US. They find in the paper that the size premium has been pervasive across markets and the magnitude of the premium had no relationship to the number of stocks in each country. So that was pretty interesting too. They sorted countries by the number of stocks from fewest stocks on average to the most. The fewest number of stocks was Ireland. The most was the US. The average number of stocks, there's huge variation, obviously. So you can see that range. Ireland had 55 stocks on average and the US had 3,763 stocks on average over the time periods they're looking at. The monthly size premium in Ireland with 55 stocks was 0.47%. For the US with 3,763 stocks, the size premium was 0.18%. There was a bunch of other countries too. These are just the ones that were in the text. There's a chart that they're speaking to, but in the text of the paper I was reading. So Italy had 233 stocks on average with a size premium of 0.15% monthly. So they kind of show with what I just said, but also in a chart, they show that there's really no relationship between the number of stocks and the size premium in the countries in this sample. And they say that the results for emerging markets were similar, but they didn't show that chart in the paper. But pretty interesting. So no relationship between number of companies and the size premium. So then the next thing that they do to kind of dig into this question is they ask if the number of the names at the time, so December 2017 data, 3,447 US stocks, they ask if that's too few stocks to observe a reliable size premium. Because that's the question, right? Is the number of names related to the size premium? So they took the full set of US data that they had, but they only took the largest 3,400 names and they held the number of names in the US market constant in this hypothetical example. So 3,400 US stocks, but looking at the same time period, 1975 to 2015, and they're taking out the smallest stocks. So it's the largest 3,400 stocks. And they find an annualized size premium of 2.22%. So even by taking out the smallest stocks, so you've got the 3,400 largest stocks in the US, holding the number of stocks constant, but the smaller stocks in the sample had a size premium of 2.22% over the largest stocks in the sample.
So the smaller of the 3,400 names.
Yep. So the largest 3,400 stocks in the US market, that's the sample, but you can still sort that into larger and smaller stocks, and the smaller stocks still had a size premium. So the point they're making really is that there's no relationship between the number of listed stocks and whether or not we should expect a reliable size premium. And we kind of asked a related question to Jay Ritter when he was on, because I've heard the narrative, and I read a portion of the listener question, but they had a little bit more in their community post related to M&A and private equity and venture capital and all that kind of stuff, mopping up the companies before they can deliver a size premium. We asked Jay Ritter about that, like because of that potential phenomenon where private equity is funding what would have previously been the small caps that would have delivered a premium. Should people be investing in private equity? And Professor Ritter's answer was basically no. And he gave more logic behind that, but that was the answer. And it was basically because he referenced a paper that came out last year that looked at the returns of private equity managers and found that they have, I think from 2005 to 2020, I believe was the sample. And he found that private equity funds delivered about the same returns as an appropriate public equity benchmark, which would have been like small cap value benchmark. So private equity delivered about the same return, but charged massive fees. And the paper was called, I think, something to do with the billionaire factory, because private equity as an industry has generated a bunch of multimillionaire and billionaire fund managers. But the investors in the funds have gotten roughly the same returns they could have gotten much cheaper from public equities.
So interesting.
Yep. So that's that. I don't think that the reduction in the number of names or the reduction in IPO activity has a whole lot to do with size premium.
So for the main topic, hard to believe inflation's on people's minds.
Yep. Figure it's appropriate to talk about it. So kind of want to talk about some details of inflation that often get overlooked, but then also talk a little bit about the potential investment implications. Because there's kind of two things, right? There's like stuff gets more expensive that makes your consumption more expensive is one side of the inflation problem. But the other side of it is that it affects asset prices. So you might be worried about stuff getting more expensive, but you might also be worried about your portfolio declining because you own stocks and bonds, which, as we'll talk more about, both tend to be negatively affected by high unexpected inflation. So I'm going to try and touch on both sides of the inflation discussion. So as I kind of alluded to, when stuff and services get more expensive, your dollars buy less of them. So as most people understand, that is inflation. And it's problematic for investors because what are we trying to do by investing? Typically, we're investing to fund future consumption. And if stuff and services are getting more expensive, well, you've got to save more, or you've got to spend less, or you've got to earn higher investment returns to sort of keep all else equal. And as I mentioned as well, high unexpected inflation can have negative impacts on stocks and more so on bonds. So stocks and bonds are not inflation hedges. Longer term bonds tend to do really poorly. But stocks, which some people I've heard say are an inflation hedge, they're really not. They tend to do worse than average when inflation is high. So that's definitely not a hedge. In the long run, stock returns have outpaced inflation, but that's a risk premium. That's very different from a hedge. You could maybe call them a long-term hedge, but I don't know if that makes as much sense.
Yeah, I saw someone on Twitter last week comment, like, you're worried about inflation at 4 or 5%. Meanwhile, your equity portfolio is up 30%+.
That's pretty good. It's true. In October 2021, and this is what has people worried. I mean, in the US, inflation has been picking up too, but obviously we're here in Canada. The Canadian Consumer Price Index was up 4.7% year over year in October 2021. And that's up from a 4.4% increase in September. The October increase was the largest since February 2003. So it sounds kind of scary. But as I mentioned, to kick this topic off, I think there's a lot of stuff that gets overlooked. So we'll try and touch on that. The first one that I think is important for people to understand is that everybody experiences inflation differently. So you take the Canadian Consumer Price Index, it's a representative basket of goods, or it's a basket of goods that's designed to match what would be consumed by a representative Canadian household. So the Canadian CPI includes food, shelter, household operations, furnishings and equipment, clothing and footwear, transportation, health and personal care, recreation, education and reading, and alcoholic beverages, tobacco products, and recreational cannabis.
That's actually a category. They say recreational cannabis.
Well, it's part of alcoholic beverages, tobacco products, and recreational cannabis, all one category. Now, I didn't write down the specific weights in the basket, but there are specific weights, again, meant to be representative. The most weight in the basket is shelter and household operations, food and transportation. So that makes up a huge chunk of the overall basket. But even with that, every household is going to spend proportionally different amounts on just those major items, let alone all the other stuff. Like you laughed about recreational cannabis, that might be a major expense in some households. In all seriousness, it could be. And that's going to be different from the representative household. So I think the first thing that people have to do before seeing like, oh no, inflation's 4.7% is kind of take a step back and figure out what your personal inflation rate is. And you can do that with, if you have a budget, I guess it's really easy because you can compare your own month over month or year over year actual spending numbers. But Statistics Canada does have a personal inflation calculator on their website. So you can use the Statistics Canada data, but you can narrow it down to your province and you can narrow it down to your specific budget. So you put in what you spend money on per month, and then they'll allocate the weights to your specific personal inflation basket, and then they'll tell you what your personal inflation was over the given time period. So when I ran my own numbers based on where my family tends to spend, my personal inflation rate was 3.1% year over year in October compared to 4.7% for the representative basket. And then even beyond that, like there's stuff like I buy my butter at Costco, and butter's apparently gone up by some meaningful amount. I don't know, 5 or 10%. According to Statistics Canada, there's a non-government agency that's organization that they're scraping web data to do their own sort of pricing index for food. And their claim is that butter's up more like 20%. But I buy my butter at Costco and it hasn't changed in price over the last year. And I buy my meat from a farm directly. And again, their prices have not gone up in the last year. So I think even listed, well, the prices might go up because there might be some feed shortages. They haven't seen that yet, but throughout the summer, the cattle are grazing in pasture, right? So there's not a not a big cost increase.
Have you bought beef in a store lately?
I don't. But yeah, I get it. So I'm just saying, though, that even based on Statistics Canada's estimates, even getting more into the weeds on my personal situation, I think 3.1% is probably an overstatement. I know you looked at it too. What was your personal inflation rate?
I was 4. So I think the big difference between your household and mine, I think we have more in electronics, communications, and insurance with more vehicles, less on food, way, way less on food than you guys. That's why I was surprised you're so much lower. I thought the food would have pulled you up a lot more.
So I think that's big. And it gets even more interesting because somebody actually in the Rationalminder community pointed me to this research from a German researcher, and she's looked at the lasting impact of inflation experiences on people's perception of inflation. She finds that every individual person is going to have different inflation expectations based on their life experiences. So she's got a 2013 paper, which was, as I understand it, a pretty important paper. And the paper's titled Learning from Inflation Experiences. And so she and some co-authors find that differences in lifetime experiences strongly predict differences in subjective inflation expectations. So it's like if you were born in a cohort of people who lived through a period of high inflation, your expectations for future inflation are going to be higher.
Wow.
Than some. Yeah, right. So yeah, it's a generational or a cohort effect where people who have lived through periods of high inflation are going to have higher inflation expectations. And they have another paper because that could be due to whatever biases or whatever. So they have another paper where they looked at members of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee. So these are people who are as close as it gets to inflation data and to understanding responses to inflation and all that stuff. And they found the same effect to be true. So the same cohort effect based on when you were born and what inflation regimes you've lived through influences your inflation expectations. Crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they had another paper where they went into, I guess, even more detail. So they looked at the exposure to grocery prices and inflation expectations. And this one was fascinating, especially considering what we just talked about like specific grocery items that you're buying. So they found that consumers rely on the price changes of goods in their personal grocery bundle when forming expectations about aggregate inflation. So people aren't thinking about their personal inflation. They're thinking about aggregate inflation, and they might be making financial decisions based on that. But what influences that? What influences your aggregate inflation expectations are the frequency of purchase and positive sign of price changes. So if you're like, I mentioned butter, if you buy butter every week and butter increases in price, that's going to have a bigger impact on your inflation expectations than some other thing that's more important to you, that's more important in terms of weight in your inflation basket, but you don't purchase as frequently. So when stuff that people buy frequently goes up in price, they increase their inflation expectations, even if that frequently purchased thing is not a big part of their consumption basket.
Like gas for your car, for example.
Yeah, so they mentioned gas. I don't remember if gas was in a paper or I listened to this researcher on a podcast too, but they talk about gas too, because you always see the price of gas. So yeah, that's another big one that can inform inflation expectations. But the interesting thing is that it forms expectations about aggregate inflation. You don't think my stuff is getting more expensive. You think, oh no, inflation as a broader concept is going to be high in the future. Now, this is important because it actually influences financial decisions that people make. So in learning from inflation expectations, they found that the biased estimates that people have about inflation based on their personal lived experience can explain household borrowing and investing behavior. So households with higher experience-based inflation estimates are more likely than other individuals to borrow using fixed rate mortgages, and they're less likely to invest in long-term nominal bonds. So it's pretty interesting. And it's, I think you could probably extrapolate that other perceived inflation hedges might be more likely to be allocated to by people that have these higher sort of subjective inflation expectations. So we talked about your personal consumption basket, not the headline inflation, the reported inflation is what matters when it comes to the impact of price increases on your consumption. But the stuff that you buy most frequently in that basket is likely to have the biggest impact on your expectations for aggregate inflation, which might influence your asset allocation decisions. Which doesn't make sense, right? Because you're biased, as we just talked about, your biased view on where inflation is going based on the stuff that you that you buy most often is probably not a very useful proxy for actual expected inflation. So I think people have to understand how their consumption basket is different from average, but I think you've also got to understand how your inflation expectations based on past inflation that you've lived through, but also based on what you buy most frequently. I think people have to understand that as well. And we see this in the Rational Minder community too, where people are talking about and actually making asset allocation decisions based on inflation expectations. Like, this is a real thing. But even that, so even refining your personal consumption basket to measure your personal inflation and adjusting your estimates based on the biases that you may have, even doing those things doesn't tell the whole story. One of the other big challenges with an aggregate consumer price index, so we talked about the 4.7% CPI, it doesn't account for substitution. And likewise, for my individual basket, so I found my personal inflation was 3.1%, but that number also doesn't account for substitution. So what's substitution? Well, when beef gets more expensive, like we talked about earlier, which it did in October 21, beef jumped up a lot in price, people might buy fish instead. And fish over this time period did not really increase in price, at least not as much. I even saw people on Reddit talking about inflation, same kind of thing, like, oh, beef is so expensive. And people are talking about how they tried tofu for the first time. That's substitution, and people will do it. Like, they're not just going to keep their heads down and keep spending the same on their consumption basket that they would have otherwise.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way. It may be a real number, but it's not taking into account change that you've made in your decision pattern.
Correct. And then that's only one of them. So that's product substitution, or I think it's called commodity substitution is the formal term for it. But the other one is outlet substitution. So in my notes, I put the example of like, if someone usually shops at Whole Foods, they might start going to No Frills. And I saw this too, actually, on Reddit, people talking about inflation, and people were talking about how they went from whatever, going to one store to No Frills, and how much cheaper various items were at No Frills. So those are two upward biases in the CPI or in any inflation index. Like, even in your own personal basket, I think you have to account for substitution, which likely people would do. And there's actually a paper I found from the Bank of Canada. And this is an interesting dynamic to observe too. So Statistics Canada comes out with an estimate. The Bank of Canada has to make policy decisions based on the Statistics Canada estimate. But the Bank of Canada actually makes these corrections to the Statistics Canada number so that they have a better estimate of the cost of living changes. And Bank of Canada is going to base their policy decisions on that, not on the raw number from Statistics Canada. So this 2012 paper that I found from the Bank of Canada is looking at the biases that I just mentioned, commodity substitution and outlet substitution. But they're also looking at biases related to new goods that are not immediately included in the CPI basket and adjustments for the quality of goods in the basket. And they found between all those different biases, there is an upward bias between 0.45 and 0.6% per year in the CPI estimate compared to the actual cost of living for a Canadian, which is pretty meaningful, right? So to state it another way, CPI is a measure of aggregate inflation, systematically overestimates the actual cost of living increase that the representative household experiences. Well, I thought that was pretty important. And now another big one, and this comes from a couple of our podcast guests, retirees or people living on fixed incomes or people with high bond allocations that are retired or close to retirement, they're often cited as the ones most exposed to inflation. I hear that all the time. That assumption completely falls apart under scrutiny. And this is a pretty well-documented phenomenon known as the retirement consumption puzzle. And that is the empirical observation that inflation-adjusted retiree expenditures tend to decrease both upon and during retirement. So we do this too. We plan for consumption increasing with inflation. And the argument, and I think my hunch is that telling people that we're not going to do that, we're going to assume you don't increase your expenses with inflation, that would make people nervous. I think planning to keep pace with inflation is comforting and it's the conservative thing to do, but it's also at odds with the empirical evidence. So empirically, the decrease in real consumption for retirees averages about 1% per year during retirement. So that means if inflation was 3% in a given year, retirement consumption would tend to increase. So still increasing, but only by 2%. So inflation's up 3%, retirement consumption is up 2%. So there's that 1% lag in real consumption per year though. So stuff's getting more expensive still for people who are retired, but their total real consumption is decreasing. So David Blanchett, guest in episode 137, he had a paper in the Journal of Financial Planning exploring the retirement consumption puzzle. He shows that there is an increase later in life. So that's why he calls it retirement spending smile, which we talked to him on the podcast. But keeping in mind that we're here in Canada, that spike in consumption later in life that Blanchett finds is largely related to healthcare expenses. And we probably wouldn't have the same experience in Canada. So you see this decreasing real consumption over time. And then Fred Vitese, we also talked to him about this. He's, of course, a retired actuary and author of a bunch of books on retirement. He told us when he was a guest on episode 104 that based on, he didn't name the studies. I could probably ask him, or it's maybe in his book, but I think he named three different studies, all from Europe. But based on those studies and his own experiences, he says retirees should plan for consumption that's growing with inflation in their 60s, inflation minus 1% in their 70s, and inflation minus 2% in their 80s. So pretty interesting. And then I think the other big one that, again, often gets overlooked in the inflation panicking is that for retirees specifically, government benefits like Canada Pension Plan, CPP, and OAS, Old Age Security, make up a portion of most people's retirement assets. So people often don't think about those as assets, but they are. So somebody might have investments, but most Canadians are still going to have some amount of CPP and OAS. And these are indexed to CPI, to the CPI All Items Index, which is an index that, as we just mentioned a minute ago, probably provides an upward biased estimate in the cost of living. So that's interesting too. So you take all that stuff together, empirical evidence of declining real consumption through retirement, got an upward bias inflation indexed pension asset in Canada Pension Plan and Old Age Security. I don't know if inflation is, I'm not saying inflation's a good thing. Like, don't get me wrong here. There's an empirical fact and there's a bit of a cushion in CPP and OAS that dampens the blow at least. Not to mention the other stuff that we talked about, like substitution. So I think the tie all that together, the effects of inflation on individual investors' consumption is complicated. The other worry that comes up with inflation that I alluded to at the beginning is the impact on financial assets. So I think for a second, we've got to take a step back and talk about the pricing of financial assets for a moment. The price of a financial asset is theoretically the present value of expected cash flows discounted at some rate. And the discount rate describes the riskiness of the cash flows. Most people that listen to this podcast have heard that. In terms of finance, it's pretty basic theory. But you can actually decompose the discount rate into multiple components. And this is stuff that goes back to research from early FAMA days, probably even before then. I haven't done as much reading pre-FAMA. So for a stock, the discount rate theoretically decomposes into a risk-free real rate, expected inflation in the discount rate. There's a term for expected inflation. A risk premium for the uncertainty about future inflation. So there we've got a real risk-free rate, expected inflation, an inflation risk premium, and a risk premium for owning stocks instead of bonds or bills. Bonds have a similar discount rate decomposition, but the risk premium is going to be different, obviously, because you're not owning a stock in that case. So if it's a corporate bond, you're going to have a credit risk premium, it might be a term risk premium. But in all cases, the important point that I'm making here is that in those discount rates, there is an inflation expectation. So I think that's pretty important. So expected inflation, the inflation that the market expects, is in prices. So if we get the inflation that is expected, you expect to be compensated for it by owning stocks or bonds. It's unexpected inflation that causes a problem for asset prices. And there's a pretty deep body of literature on this relationship. Fama and Schwert have a 1977 paper on that topic. Fama's got a 1981 paper, and Budok and Richardson have a 1993 paper. And they all kind of formalize this negative relationship between asset prices and inflation. So it's kind of accepted as fact. Dimson, Marsh, and Staunton, I always love cross-referencing other findings with their stuff just because they have their unique data set. So they document the same relationship for 21 countries back to 1900. And they show that high inflation has been negative for real stock returns, and long bonds have been impacted more dramatically than stocks when inflation is very high. In deflationary periods, bonds have outperformed stocks by a wide margin. So if we could predict a deflationary period, we would rather hold bonds. In high inflation, bonds do worse than stocks, but stocks also have relatively poor performance. So, I mean, the intuition on why does this happen is pretty straightforward, I think. We just talked about discount rate. So the discount rate for a nominal bond includes an inflation expectation and an inflation risk premium. If inflation expectations or inflation uncertainty increase, bond prices should fall, and longer dated bonds are going to be more sensitive to changes in the discount rate in terms of their price. So I think for bonds, it's pretty straightforward. Their cash flows are more certain, fixed income. That's all pretty easy to think about. The mechanism for stocks, as usual, is a little bit more complicated. The discount rate is still affected. So if inflation expectations go up, discount rates for stocks go up, prices go down. But cash flows can also be affected by inflation expectations. So it makes it a little bit messier of a relationship. But empirically, we know stock performance decreases. Stocks don't do as well under inflation. So because stocks tend to perform poorly under high inflation, like I mentioned earlier, they're definitely not an inflation hedge. They do deliver that risk premium, or they're expected to deliver the real risk premium above inflation. But in the short run, they're certainly not an inflation hedge. And then longer dated bonds, or even intermediate bonds, not so good in inflation. Short dated bonds, and we talked about this in a previous episode, if you're holding 1 month bills and rolling them over, historically that has offered some inflation protection. If central banks raise rates to combat inflation, if they take that action, then short-term bills prices aren't really going to be affected because they have such short maturities, but you'll be able to roll them over at higher yields, which historically has been protective in inflationary periods. So the big question though that people start asking is, if stocks and bonds don't offer protection in high inflation periods, and they may even take a hit, should we be adding other stuff to the portfolio? If there was an asset that tends to increase in price when inflation is high, that seems like it'd be a pretty good asset to add to a portfolio if you're worried about inflation. But that asset is unfortunately pretty elusive. There's a 2021 paper, U.S. Inflation and Global Asset Returns. I thought it was a pretty thoughtful paper. It's a working paper, not published. So they look at the relationship between U.S. inflation and the performance of global assets, including bonds, stocks, stock industry portfolios, factor risk premiums. They looked at size, value, they looked at premiums. They also looked at style portfolios. So like the value premium, the size premium, but also the small cap value long only portfolio and the value long only portfolio. They looked at commodities and they looked at REITs over the period 1927 to 2020 for most asset classes, and 1991 to 2020 for all of the asset classes that I just mentioned. One of the interesting things that they find is that in their samples, the average real returns are lower in years with higher inflation for most of the assets they look at. But the differences are not statistically reliable, especially in the more recent sample. And despite the lower returns, So not statistically reliable, but still lower. Despite the lower returns, most assets still have positive average returns in the high inflation years. The assets they found that did have positive correlations with expected and unexpected inflation in the post-1991 sample were energy stocks and commodities. So I think people have probably heard of those assets being a potential inflation hedge, but they found that the volatility of those assets would have made them poor inflation hedges. Energy stocks and commodities had returns that were about 20 times as volatile as inflation, and more than half of their return variance is not explained by inflation. So to the extent that an inflation hedge is designed to reduce the uncertainty of real consumption, which I think that's what you're trying to get out of it, the high volatility of commodities and energy stocks makes them pretty unsuitable. So they do have a positive relationship with inflation. They tend to do well when inflation is high, but they're much more volatile, and a big portion of that volatility is unrelated to inflation.
Isn't that interesting?
Yep. So the style portfolios, value and small cap value, they did have lower returns under high inflation than under low inflation. So you're better off owning value and small cap value portfolio when inflation was low than when it was high. But the thing that I found interesting here is that they still delivered meaningfully positive excess returns compared to the market in periods of high inflation. The average annual U.S. market return under high inflation from 1927 to 2020 was 4.91%, while the small cap value portfolio under high inflation was 11.95%, and the large cap value portfolio was 8.13%. So you still had excess returns compared to the market if you were allocating to the value and small cap value portfolios. REITs were another one in the 1991 to 2020 sample. Emerging markets too. They're not inflation hedges because they don't have the correlation with inflation that commodities or energy stocks have. But I think the takeaway that I had looking at the data in this paper is that even if you don't have the perfect inflation hedge in a portfolio that's diversified across multiple sources of expected return is going to be more resilient in periods of high domestic inflation. There's a paper that last time we covered inflation as a topic. There was a paper looking at international equities as an inflation hedge. I think it's the same kind of idea. The more independent risk premiums you can add to a portfolio, the more resilient your expected returns are going to be, even if you have high domestic inflation.
Which you would expect to outperform inflation, but you just can't call it a hedge.
Correct. You expect a long-run risk premium. You're going to have a more reliable outcome if you have more sources of expected return. I didn't mention that with commodities. The other issue with them is that they, outside of high inflation periods, historically, their return's been really low. All of those other assets that we just mentioned, while they don't provide that inflation hedging property in the sense that they're not correlated with inflation, but they've all had positive returns outside of inflationary periods. Whereas commodities, you get these spikes in returns when inflation's high, but outside of it, you have low or negative real returns. And then I wanted to touch on one more aspect of commodities. I just find commodities to be interesting. Correlations are unstable. People generally get that. You don't want to look at past correlations and assume that they're going to continue in the future. Those relationships can be very non-stationary. There's a paper, Inflation Hedging in the Long Run, Practical Perspectives from 7 Centuries of Commodity Prices. The authors investigate the inflation hedging ability of 50 commodities for 80 countries and 7 centuries of data. I thought that was just an interesting perspective. In the paper, they do actually say that in their view, you should have some commodities in your portfolio, but I took their result differently. I'll explain why. So they do confirm that commodities have had a positive correlation with inflation, particularly over longer horizons of years or decades. But they find that the inflation hedging capacity of commodities has changed over time. So agricultural commodities offered protection until the beginning of the 19th century. And then coincident with the start of the Industrial Revolution, energy and industrial commodities offered greater protection. And then more recently, energy commodities offered the greatest level of protection during the second half of the 20th century. So the optimal inflation hedging commodity basket has been different throughout time. And I think if you think about like, okay, so energy commodities have recently been the best inflation hedge, but you got to wonder just with the increase in uptake of electric vehicles and the hoped for decrease in reliance on fossil fuels, you got to wonder if energy commodities will continue to be the best inflation hedge for the next 50 years. I don't have the answer, of course, just posing it as a point of interest. So the other thing, so there's variation in hedging capacity over time for different commodity baskets, but it also differs across regions. So to get the highest level of protection from commodities as an inflation hedge, not only do you have to pick the right commodity basket at the right time, but you've got to pick the right commodity basket at the right time for your region, which is going to differ from region to region. Now, I think an aggregate commodity basket still offers some inflation protection, but the point is that that optimal inflation hedge, it's not commodities. It's like a commodity basket. I don't know if we could predict which one. And then, of course, like I mentioned before, the expected returns outside of high inflation periods are super low, which is problematic. So kind of like we concluded last time that we talked about a somewhat similar topic, I don't really think people need to look any further than a properly diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds with, of course, exposure to multiple sources of expected return. That's, I didn't touch on it too much, but the other side of value doing well relative to the market in high inflation periods, growth didn't do so well. And that's not a statistically reliable relationship, but it shows up in the data. That's it.
Excellent. Ready for some talking sense cards?
Ready.
All right. So this is from the University of Chicago's Financial Education Initiative. And as you said earlier, available in our online store. Okay. Imagine you have reached your financial dreams. What words would people use to describe you? So I'll give you a break and go first. So as we've said many times before, I think Dr. Moira Summers talked about this, how more money makes you more of who you are. So if I reached my financial dreams, I would hope that people describe me pretty much the same way as I was always. Perhaps a little more time on my hands, perhaps more free family time, perhaps relaxed, although I think I'm reasonably relaxed now. What words would people use to describe you if you've reached your financial dreams?
I don't know what my financial dreams are, so.
I knew you were going to say that.
I don't. I mean, would I love to have a big pile of money? Sure. But I wouldn't say this is a dream. I don't dream about it. I don't have a good answer.
I don't see either of us changing a whole lot. Like, it's not like the sign goes up and says, okay, you've made it. Now you're going to behave differently. I don't even know how we would do that.
I would hope, it's like what you said, I would hope that people would describe me the same way that they describe me now if I had a bunch of money. I think if it would be a problem, I think, if I would expect to be a different person after reaching the financial, maybe that's why I don't have financial dreams.
Next one. An old saying goes, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. What do you think this means?
Well, if you have something, you're not taking risk, I think. If you have a bird, you're not taking risk. If there are two birds in the bush, you have to take some risk to try and acquire them. And there's a chance you get no birds.
Don't be greedy. But you could also think about it long-term, though. Two in the bush could be doubling your money with compounding as opposed to consuming it today. You could consume twice as much tomorrow. It's kind of like that marshmallow experiment with the kids, right?
Yeah, but the birds are in a bush, though.
So go the other way, which is don't be greedy today.
When you read, of course, I've heard this saying before. When you're reading it, my brain was saying liquidity premium. I don't know. That's where my brain went. But then you think about it. These birds are in a bush. You're not locking them up in an illiquid asset. You don't know if you're going to get them back. They're in a bush. What are you going to do? If I'm holding a bird in my hand, that bird's mine. If it's, I couldn't go catch two birds right now. I couldn't go catch one bird right now. I could not walk outside. There are birds outside my house. I could not go and catch one.
So it's a risk management story from your perspective, not a compounding asset story.
I don't think birds are going to compound unless they're going to mate, I guess. And maybe then I can go at some point. There are so many birds that it's easy to catch them. I don't know.
Oh my God. Do you want one more?
Sure.
I pull this one at random. Think about a time when you made a decision that didn't turn out well. What did you learn?
Oh, geez.
Think about a time you made a decision that didn't turn out well. What did you learn? I can't think about one.
Jeez.
We're both stumped.
Yeah, that's a really tough question.
I guess that's the point of these cards. Really make you think.
Does that mean that we don't learn from our mistakes, or does it mean that we don't make
poor decisions? Or I don't know what it means. Maybe it's just too much pressure to think about it.
Oh, geez. Yeah, I got nothing.
I'm just thinking. I mean, I think we're pretty good here at work about learning from decisions that we may have made that didn't turn out great. We just learn from it and change the process going forward. Lately, I think we've learned a lot about learning from other people's experiences. So not that we made a poor decision, but sometimes I think I would have had more confidence in my decision. But for example, you asked me what I thought about a website you saw, and you thought I didn't like it. That's not true. I was more ambivalent. I'd rather see the data about whether or not the website is going to work the way we want it to work, as opposed to passing judgment right away. So I'm becoming perhaps less certain about my judgment on certain things and more respectful of other people's opinions into it, and especially the data into something.
Hmm.
These cards work. They've made us think.
I got one. Early in my career of working, I took a job working for someone, and that job didn't work out. And I think I learned about just doing due diligence on people. And that's a lesson that I've probably carried with me since then. Like, if you're going to get involved with a person professionally, but I guess otherwise too, understanding who they are and what their motivations are and even what their history is, I think is something that's pretty important.
It's a good answer. Three good cards. Okay. That's a wrap.
That's it.